welcome to another edition of Turn Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, someone I've been on the road with for many years now, an old friend of mine, Jasmine White Gluz of the band No Joy, also of the band Bad Flirt. That's how I first met her years ago, touring in Bad Flirt. Anyway, more on that in a second. But first, if you would like to get in touch with me, you can head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com, and send me an email there. And you know what? Any more requests for those t-shirts? I think we have a couple more left, so send them on in. I know I keep saying that, and it's because I really haven't had a chance to go through and check the sizes. So maybe hold off on sending emails about those shirts. Yeah, I got to figure this shirt thing out. Anyway, but if you would like to get in touch with me more immediately, not about shirts again, you can hit me up on Twitter @LeftForDamien or find me on Instagram @LeftForDamien. You can also you can find us on Facebook. There's a Turned On Punk Facebook page run by my brother and show producer, Tristan Abraham. Tristan, thank you for doing all this hard work that you do. Anyway, Tristan will get the message to me. You can also post things up on that Turned On Punk Facebook page and, you know, interact, and there's stuff that people send into the show that gets posted up there. But if you don't use Facebook, you want to see that kind of stuff, you can go over to the turnedoutapunk.tumblr.com. There's a Tumblr page as well. You can also find this show on iTunes if you use iTunes. And if you do use iTunes, please subscribe to this podcast and rate it and write a review for it if you are so inclined. And while you're there, you'll see there are other podcasts in the Turned Out a Punk family, such as Turned Out a Punk Footnotes, hosted by Chris O'Toole and myself, where we dissect Turned Out a Punk episodes and kind of get into the nitty-gritty, get into the discographies, get into the label histories, all kinds of nerdy crap. We also get into a fun mailbag show on there too. So anyway, Turned Out a Punk Footnotes is where you want to check that stuff out. And if you are someone who is interested in cannabis and would like to hear two medical patients that are prescribed cannabis discussing issues around cannabis, please tune into Oil and Flowers, hosted by my good buddy Buddha Blaze. And I'm kind of like in that sidecar riding on that motorcycle with him, or beside that motorcycle with him. You know, I'm like the Andy Richter to his Conan. Like, he's the host, I'm the co-host on that thing, because believe me, he knows a great deal about that wonderful plant. The cannabis plant, that is. Well, I guess it's kind of several plants. Anyway, that's the kind of nerdy shit we get into on that show. So you will find those podcasts also in that feed. And if you do not use iTunes and you want to find those podcasts, they are posted in feeds on all sorts of other podcast mediums out there. So if you want to support this podcast on those, do so. Whatever you do on those types of mediums to support podcasts, please find a way and do it. And that would be great. Thank you very much. Speaking of support, the best way to support this podcast that anyone has found so far are the fine folks at Vans, other than you, of course, telling all your friends. But, I mean, Vans gave me money, so I didn't have to pay for this out of my own pocket anymore, which is awesome. So thank you very much, Vans, and they just let me book whoever I want to book. And that's who I keep booking. And also, there are going to be some cool things happening in the near future with Vans and myself and Turned Out a Punk. We will be going on some live trips again this summer, so I will be heading out on that road very soon to talk to you about all sorts of cool things, you know, and maybe meet some of you. If I'm at one of those festivals, you know, come and say hi. And that's, once again, thanks, Vans. So today on the show, Jasmine. Now, Jasmine is someone that I've known for a number of years. We've gotten a tour together in two different bands. Her and Laura were the sort of front people, I guess is the best way to put it, in Bad Flirt, who were the band that we played with first, and then, of course, went on to form No Joy, where they found my cousin, Garland, who was the drummer in that band for a good number of years and no longer is the drummer in the band, but Jasmine has continued to release unbelievable music. She's got a brand new collaboration with Sonic Boom from Spaceman 3 that you have to hear because it's very interesting, fascinating. We talk about actually Spaceman 3. I'll get to this note right now later on in this episode, and I'm so excited I just refer to him as Pete. So just so you're forewarned, when I say Pete, I mean Sonic Boom from Spaceman 3. But anyway, she's collaborated with him and yeah, just kind of really made a name for being at the forefront of trippy, psyched out, kind of shoegazy, flavored guitar rock. And she's someone that I knew came from, of course, the punk rock. And so what better way to kind of find out about all the stuff that I've never gotten to talk to her about than by having her as a guest on the show. This show really exists so I can have all these sorts of conversations with friends where, you know, it really just isn't ever something that comes up. But now I can, because I have this show. So this is fantastic. This is a fun episode. Jasmine has some amazing stories and is, as I say to her in this, like, someone that has a story that is truly inspiring and someone that, you know, fucking had to carve their own path, force their way into the music scene that wasn't letting them into the music scene, and has done so in spectacular fashion and, yeah, an inspiration. So everyone, please sit back, relax, and enjoy Jasmine White Gluz on Turned Out a Punk.
Horrific reality.
Jasmine, I could talk to you forever about wrestling, but that is not why you're here. Thank you so much for coming
on
the show.
Of course.
We have been many places around the world playing together.
Yes.
But we are now in one of the dingiest backstages we've ever been in.
This is probably one of the worst, but, you know, here we are.
I think the coolest one was the subway train on the roof in England.
That was in London.
In London.
Yeah, that was great.
It was a fantastic view and everything.
It's like in a train. It was really fun.
Yeah, but you know what?
It's okay.
Yeah, they have not had all three Hank Williams play at that venue. They have here at the Horseshoe.
Oh my God. They don't call it the legendary.
Exactly. Yeah. Legendary comes with a funky price sometimes.
Oh God, yeah. It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah. But that's not why we're here. We're not here to discuss the decor.
Yes.
We're here to discuss you. And I got to start this off the way I start them all off, which is, Jasmine, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
I don't know the first time, let's say, but I think it definitely was through Hole.
Mm-hmm.
Like, listening to Hole and seeing women play guitar and then going down that rabbit hole, like, what's Bikini Kill? What's L7? And then, like, exploring from there.
Yeah.
I think that was probably my first, where I took it really seriously. Growing up, too, there was always, like, I like the Ramones, or I'm this, when you're, you know, trying to fit into, like, a little mold. But I think Hole was the first band where I was like, oh, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
I get what's going on here. So.
And had you been to any concerts or anything before that? Because you've mentioned, like, you know, being in the Ramones, that's kind of like a deeper cut for a young kid to get
maybe
into.
Maybe. I think, actually, my first show, I don't know if you were there, Garland was at the same show that I went to.
Really?
So Garland must have been, like, 8, because I was 13, I think.
Yeah.
It was No Doubt with Siv and the Vandals.
Wow, no, I was not at that show. But that tour came here.
Yeah, so it was in Montreal. It was, like, 1996, I think, or 97. So that was the first show that I saw.
Was that before you had heard Hole, or is that after you?
It was after. That was after. But I think I have pretty cool parents, so also they were, like, really into Bowie and really into Tom Petty and just, like, always had music around and music magazines, so I would always just kind of go through that and, like, pick up on stuff.
Because I was going to say, you're the first siblings that have ever been on this show.
Oh, no way!
Yeah, we've never had any siblings before, but I guess it, like, speaks to the musical household you grew up in.
Yeah, definitely. We always had music around. So
was that where you would hear the Ramones when you were, like, in the Ramones?
Yeah.
Your parents would have that stuff?
I think they just, like, had it around. They would always buy, like, books about music and anthologies about music, and there was always vinyl around, and they'd always have, like, vinyl that I don't even think they honestly listened to, but they probably just, like, got from people and had it around, so I'd always go through it and see, like, what's Blondie, what's this, but it was kind of just Ramones and things like that were, like, the big bands that you kind of already knew what they were, even if you hadn't heard them. So I was just like,
And where did you first hear Hole, do you remember?
I think it probably was, like, Much Music or something like that. I think it was definitely, like, I didn't hear about them before they were very big, I think. Or, like, Live Through This
came out.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was Much Music or maybe the radio. But I think Much Music. and the Wedge were always really good resources to like see what was going on.
It's weird to like grow up now and like I still like muscle memory go to Much Music.
Like 30, mine is 35.
Mine was 29. Yeah. You know, and it's still 29. Yeah. So like muscle memory is like so 29.
Funny. So funny.
And then, but it's never music.
Yeah. Never, which is really bad.
I'm like, please, please, please.
Something.
Please. No whammies, no whammies.
Oh, no.
And then it's never.
No.
But yeah, it was, but what was the, like the rock radio in Montreal?
It was pretty funny because there's obviously like some stuff that does well in Montreal that doesn't do well elsewhere.
Yeah.
There's a lot of acts that will just like thrive. So there's a lot of like a lot of prog was always popular, and a lot of stuff like I don't know, like there was Shom, the rock radio station. You know, there's a lot of that. I also listened to The Buzz, which was coming from Vermont, but that you could pick it up on the radio in Montreal.
Yeah,
so
I've heard that.
They had like the alternative station. That was probably when I was in high school, and they played like. That's probably when I like got into new metal because they play all that kind of stuff. And when you listen to it now, it's like they still play stuff from like 1998. Where you're like, oh, okay, there's no new music.
That's what happens to all those like alternative stations. They just kind of like froze.
Yeah, just like Green Day and like Pearl Jam and some like I don't know.
Alice in Chains.
Yeah, Alice in Chains. Big, big.
Korn.
Big on the Korn.
Big on the Korn.
Big on the Korn.
What was the I guess that drew you to like. Like whole and like aggressive guitar music more than any other type of music.
I just thought it was like, I don't know, between seeing people like Courtney Love or Kim Gordon like kind of being stars but not having to like be a pop star was really interesting to me and having this like, they were just also like badass. Yeah. They just were so cool and Melissa Auftemar, who was from Montreal, like, she joined Hole, so it was this sort of, like, myth of, like, oh, my God, like, she was plucked from here, and now she's in the band, and, like, I remember watching Hole Unplugged, just being like, this is, like, the best thing I've ever seen, because it's so punk, but it's, like, acoustic, and so, I don't know, there's just something about that, like, I mean, pictures of me of that era are so ugly, because I tried to, like, do the, like, baby clips, and, like, the baby dresses, but I was just, like, a weird tween that like looks so bad.
The baby clips were popular in my house.
Yeah.
And myself, we would put them in our hair too.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the time.
It was the time. It was the time. But I just liked how they were like in charge. It kind of seemed like they were in charge of the stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, because I was wondering, like, I guess that's what I was trying to get at. Like, if you had known that Melissa was in the band at that point, was that like a big.
That was a big thing, yeah.
I remember that here was a big thing.
Yeah, it was a big thing because I didn't really know her. I didn't. Know her personally, but I knew of her local bands, and like they were kind of like around in Montreal. But when she joined, it was like a media blitz. Like everyone was just talking about it because it was kind of at the height of their whole success is when she joined. So it was sort of like it made this like weird thing. Like maybe someone's gonna ask me to join their big band. I can play. Yeah, just wait for the call. But
okay, because Melissa's. Father was like a, he's like a famous journalist.
Yeah,
or was famous.
Yeah,
wrestler,
that's right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I think he worked for the Gazette.
Yeah,
the Gazette. So, and then she went to the same college I did, and it just like yeah, it was just like this really cool connection, and I don't know.
Have you gotten to meet her since?
Yeah, yeah. We played Basilica Soundscape where she was. I think she built the building or she helped curate it. So yeah, we played it and we did a panel with her at North by Northeast.
She's so nice.
So nice. So nice. Like, yeah. She was just like always a vision as a young person being like, oh my gosh, that could be me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Especially because like someone who, like as you say, they were the biggest band in the world
and
that time.
Yeah. And she was just like, she wasn't a local star, let's say.
Yeah,
like it wasn't
yeah.
like she was like a already a hugely established artist. She just like kind of got plucked and joined the band and was like, whoa.
Yeah.
So cool.
That's awesome. So where did you kind of go, you know, you found Hole, you heard them. Where did you kind of go from there? Were you buying records or CDs at that point?
Yeah. Yeah. I was buying lots of records. Really trying to go to a lot of shows. Like, my friends and I just felt like we had to go to all the shows, which is now not what I do, but it's one thing where you're like, oh, there are this many shows happening. I have to go to them all because, especially if they're all ages, you're like, I just have to go to all of them. And it was that sort of thing that like, you'd see a show listing with the headliner band and then you'd see the openers or the support. And then the next time the support came, it's like, well, they opened for that band, and I like that band, so I have to go see them now. So we would always go to, like, Lex in Montreal.
What's that place?
Lex, it was an all-ages venue across from Fofun Electric.
Oh, I know Fofun. Yeah. But I don't think I ever went to Lex or anything.
Yeah, it was all-ages. They had, like, mostly punk and hardcore, but then, I mean, they had some, I saw Piebald there. I've seen, like, indie bands there, too. It shut down, but it was all-ages, and it was kind of, like, the place to go.
Was it bigger than Linko Cafe? Like,
it was a little bit... I don't know if it was a little bigger, but it was just a little bit more... They had a lot of touring acts through there. Yeah. And it was sort of like the place to be seen.
I think you could imagine Cafe Linko, if you were a touring act, would not have been the...
The best...
you have been... What?
Like,
we're here.
What are we doing? Like, the front was like a AA, I
believe. It was an AA.
Yeah.
It was an AA clubhouse.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And as a straight edge person, I could...
Right, yeah. It was... I mean, that place was fun. I always found it was a little out of the way.
It was very,
like,
out of the way.
Papineau or something. So Lex was, like, right across from Fofs and Metropolis, and you could kind of, like, take the subway there, and it was all ages, and you kind of got to know the same people. And I met a bunch of people. This makes me seem like a loser, but I met a bunch of people because we would just, like, wait out to meet the bands after shows.
Yeah.
Even if I didn't like them, I'd just be like, oh, I just wanted them to sign something, which was very stupid.
I used to do that.
Yeah.
I got a shirt signed by every band I saw the first couple years
really?
Of the shows.
Yeah. I was going through some of my... I have, like, a lot of clothes in storage, but I found, like, a Zucker Baby shirt. Do you remember Zucker Baby?
Zucker Baby.
This is, like, CanCon 1998. Like, I don't... Or Glue Leg, I think they
were. Glue Leg. I remember Glue Leg. Yeah. Definitely.
I found, like, signed t-shirts where I was like, why did I do this? Like, why do I still have this?
Gotta play Much Music for that.
Yeah, definitely. Like, Age of Electric, all the, like, KCON stuff, I definitely, like...
Age of Electric's pretty sick, though.
It's pretty good.
Yeah,
like... Limlifter, even better.
Limlifter's sick.
Yeah.
And Limlifter, I think, because of the new Pornographers...
Yeah.
...has been kind of, like, accepted...
As, like, a... It's not embarrassing.
It's not Glue Leg. Just on Glue Leg.
How often does Glue Leg come up in your podcast?
I was actually thinking, how many times did Glue Leg sit in this very room we're sitting in?
Oh no, probably the ghost of Glue Leg are here. Oh god.
But it's a very weird time to look back at, like, Canadian popular music because you had a lot of stuff that I don't necessarily revisit now, but then you had Sloan, you had Limlifter, you had Age of Electric, you had...
There was some cool stuff.
Yeah.
There was some really cool stuff. It was just a weird time, too, because I remember a lot of stuff I couldn't always... It was hard sometimes to find the records, too. You'd have to, like, really hunt to find certain things because it wasn't always at HMV, like, at the mall that you could go to. So, like, finding independent record stores was always a little bit of a... In the burbs didn't exist, so I'd have to travel to get to them.
What were, like, some of the independent stores at that time that you were going?
Oh, gosh. Because Lex had a record store on top of
it. Oh, really?
Yeah, so there was, like, the show venue in the bottom, and then upstairs was a record store.
Was that, like, did it used to be that store, like, way out at a mall, and it was, like, a punk store, and it had, like, a skate thing in the back, and it was, like, in the way north in the city, I think?
I don't know. Maybe?
I'm trying to remember the name. The guy had a label... I'll fix this.
Oh my god!
I can't remember what it is, but it's like
I don't, maybe.
And then it just became a skate store, and it moved downtown a little bit.
Oh, Underworld?
More.
No,
Underworld.
Underworld. It was across the street from Underworld.
Oh, okay.
It was exactly across the street. Yeah. So that was like the trifecta. You go to Lex, you go to Underworld, you go to Fofs. You're like hitting all the marks. So that I remember that record store. It was pretty great.
It was awesome.
Yeah, they had a lot of stuff.
I remember going there for the first time, and it was just like all these records that I only read about in fanzines. How do they have this?
Yeah.
This is from Europe.
Yeah. That was... I also started, probably later in my teens, but I started a fake blog, a fake magazine so I could get press passes to shows. So I got into, like, all the Warped Tours and lots of shows where I'd interview the bands, but, like, honestly, the interviews went nowhere.
Do you still have the tapes?
I don't think so. Like, I feel like there's some good ones. I remember interviewing My Chemical Romance in a women's bathroom at Rainbow, which was a venue in NDG, which another all ages venue.
That would have been an early time for them coming through. Right?
It would have been like 2002, maybe 2001,
okay,
or something like that. Maybe 2002.
Okay,
they were definitely like support on some other show.
Okay, yeah.
But my friends and I would just like, yeah, we're gonna interview the bands, and like, I mean, so if I was the band getting interviewed by these dumbass 16-year-olds just being like, so, here are our questions. Like, and it was going nowhere. It was just so I'd get into the shows for free.
Yeah.
So we did that a lot. And then I kind of, like, let that turn into, when I actually realized that I liked writing, I started writing for Exclaim. Okay. And then I got a lot of records from them to review, which are still available on the Exclaim website, and it's extremely embarrassing. It is horrifying to see how much I liked, like, some like, scream out, like, some Tooth and Nail scream out that I was really into. Gave it glowing reviews, but yet, like, reviewed Arcade Fire live and was like, this sucks! Like, I was just not... clearly not that good at journalism, but that's how I got a lot of records.
You're like a young person, like, you know, kind of finding...
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, now, like in times past, that would just be in some shitty zine that no one would remember.
Exactly. But now it's like, you Google my name or anything, and it's like, that's up there. That's right there.
Your fanzine travels with you now.
Oh, gosh.
Well, we kind of, you know, and Tristan and I did that same scam, too, of having a fake zine. And, but I, if you found those tapes, that's your podcast. You just put out those old tapes now.
Oh, my God.
And that can't be, you know, you're saying 16-year-olds, you know, but I get interviewed and you get interviewed by some pretty dumb adults.
That's true. So. That's true. Actually, that's true. So maybe it was endearing.
I was going to say, like, a bunch of high-energy young people interviewing me would be a lot more endearing than some completely out-of-touch person my age.
True. You have a point. You do have a point. It's true.
Well, on to this next out-of-touch person's question.
No.
But, like, where did you kind of get into that screamo stuff? So you started going to these shows. What were some of the bands... you know, other than Blue Leg.
Yeah.
That stood out to you.
I'm trying to think. Like, obviously, like, the Midwestern emo stuff, like Braid. Even, like, Get Up Kids, stuff like that. We got it. I was into.
Where were you hearing that stuff? Because that wasn't playing on the radio.
No. You know what's weird? It was, I remember hearing about Get Up Kids through, you would get, like, sometimes if you'd order... So I'd order Blink-182 records, and then they would have something that would be like, Tom's pick is, Mark's pick is. So Mark's pick was Get Up Kids. Tom's pick was Fugazi, which is how I first heard Fugazi, which is embarrassing. But that's so I would learn, like, oh, if Tom likes Fugazi, I do too. I'll just buy it blindly. And Get Up Kids was Mark's pick, and then Get Up Kids were, like, support on a Blink show or something.
What were you ordering? Like, what Blink-182 stuff? Like, just singles, or?
I think it was, like... It just was was it drive-through? I'm not sure what the label was.
Oh, yeah, they had their own thing, right?
They had their own thing. It would just, like, come with the record that you bought.
That's kind of cool that they do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I heard about Jimmy Eat World, too. Yeah. It was, like, they, I think that was Mark's pick was Jimmy Eat World. So it was like, oh, cool, Jimmy Eat World, I like this. So a lot of that, like, kind of emo stuff.
That was also the bands of that era, like, were kind of, like, paying it forward and picking up, like, smaller bands.
Totally.
Remember, like, you know, I mentioned No Doubt bringing Civ on tour.
Yeah.
And, like, Green Day bringing Pansy Division on tour and stuff like that. Yeah, it's just, like, it's, like, you know, it's, like, I'd like to think that if I ever found myself in a really popular band, I would have the same presence in mind.
Yeah, totally.
You know, but I probably let the label pick the band.
But it's cool. I mean, and I thought about a funny thing that happens, like, so the first band I ever saw live was Civ. And then we just did a tour with Quicksand.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was like, hey, Walter, like, actually, he didn't play that show.
No.
It's just like, this is a weird fact.
Well, I think he wasn't contractually allowed to be in the band.
Something about that, where he, like, wrote stuff, but then he wasn't ever there.
To be in it.
Yeah.
He's, like, without a doubt, one of the nicest people I've met in music.
The greatest human.
Yeah.
Just, I don't even know how a person that, like, perfect exists, but it does, and it's Walter Trifles.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Well, especially, you know, you read about the craziness of the scene he came out of.
And he's... Yeah. I know.
Him and Melissa Auf-Demar, you know, both have, like, they must have to be really just grounded people to be able to ride those waves.
I know. I don't even know. Like, and we did that tour with him, and, like, well, we did tour with Quicksand, but we did one in Europe where... The bus broke. We were all supposed to share a bus, and the bus broke down, so we ended up cramming into a Sprinter all together. And, like, we're used to being in a small band, but, like, Sergio, the bass player of Quicksand, he's in the Deftones. Yeah. Like, he had a fine time, but probably hasn't toured in a van in, like, 20 years or something. But Walter was just, like, totally... He tours with Dead Heavens in a van. That he just, like, tours all the time, playing so much music, and it's... I admire somebody that, like... likes music that much, because it's to have that commitment is really to be in so many different projects and be able to be great at all of them is really something.
Yeah, I think that for me is like the mark of like genius, is where you can do it once.
Yeah.
And that's luck and that's timing, but to be able to do it multiple times with different bands.
It's crazy.
It makes you wonder though, like, if it's something that he just, you know, feels compelled to like want to keep doing something new, like if it's just the people around him not having the same drive.
I don't know. I think he just has like a lot of ideas.
Yeah.
I think he's just likes a lot of different stuff and like has a lot of creative output, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Because it's can be exhausting.
It can be so exhausting. I'm so exhausted.
Yeah.
Creatively doing stuff.
Oh my God, I know.
And I wasn't in Moondog. I got nothing to brag about. I got nowhere to lay my hat. So when you're going to these all ages shows, were you playing music at this point already?
I started shortly after that. It was kind of weird because I would go to shows and want to be playing, but like really not know what I was doing at all. So I played solo, like acoustic, a lot of times, and played original stuff. I'd have a four track with like some backup beats and stuff that I'd be playing. Yeah. Yeah.
Where was that influence coming from? Or is that just...
I wanted to have something else there. And the only other piece of equipment I had was a Tascam and four track. So it was just like, okay, I'm going to use this live because it's the only other thing I have. So I would just like make these very bad beats, like funky drummer style beats on my home desktop computer, or like record them off a shitty Casio keyboard and then play them live and just like play to them.
That's awesome.
But like I wasn't very good.
Yeah, for a kid to be doing that.
Yeah, I don't even think I knew how to tune a guitar at that point. But it was just like wanted to do something, and there wasn't a lot of other women.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really ever meet. Like I was always playing with. I was always like a girl opening for like a show full of guys. So it was hard to like figure out what I wanted to do because there wasn't really anybody doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Just kind of winging it.
it's funny too, because I'm thinking back to the bands that I knew from Montreal around then, and it's like it's all dudes.
Yeah. There were people, but there wasn't as much like helping each other out or like somebody being like having someone to look up to. It was a little bit different.
Because the next wave, though, of stuff, like when you guys came out and then like AIDS Wolf, there's just like so many just powerful women out of that scene, you know.
For sure.
But it just, you're right, like it must have been.
Maybe I didn't know where to look as a kid, too. Like I wasn't so. I mean, I lived in the suburbs. I was trying to like figure stuff out. Maybe I didn't know where to look. So I was just sort of like doing my thing.
What was your first show?
My first official show, I was a little bit older. I think I was 18. And I had played at parties or, like, people's houses. And I think I played Lex once. But the first official show was at Kazza opening for Jonah Matranga.
Who?
One Line Drawing.
Well, One Line Drawing?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Because my friend Chrissy, who had a band called One Candle Power.
Yeah.
And this was, like, already 2000, I think. Was just like, hey, just play a show, like just open for us and do it. So that was like the first time I played. And then I mean there was lots of shit that happened where like I opened for I think that band VHS or Beta
one time.
And I did a Britney Spears cover, and then they like in their interviews for like a year would be like, we played with the shittiest singer, she did a Britney Spears cover, it wasn't even funny. But I was like a kid, I was like 17 or 18, I don't even remember the exact age, but there was like, you know, I would just take any show even if it didn't matter. So there was a lot of playing at people's houses or, like, house parties or house shows.
Were you doing it under a name at this point? Or what?
I did it under Bad Flirt, actually.
Oh, it was so, Bad Flirt.
Yeah,
so Bad Flirt's already started at this point.
Yeah, it started just as me.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, and so it was just solo stuff. And then it was kind of like, okay, I should probably get a band because this is pretty bad. Like, this isn't what I want to do anyway. So I like switched from acoustic to electric, and then sort of just tried to find people to collaborate with. So sometimes it would just be like another guitarist or a bassist or a drummer, and then somehow like different people came in and sort of formed a couple times different lineups. But yeah.
Were you always going for that sound that Bad Flirt would wind up sounding like?
Not really.
Yeah.
Like I don't know. I find like whenever I do music, I don't know what it's supposed to sound like. But I will say that I always kind of, at that point, I was very influenced by you know, like 480s, shoegaze kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you were one of the first people to be like, you know what you sound like? And you were like, this shoegaze band. And I like never heard it before. I was like, I don't know what that is, but it sounds like what I hope we're going to sound like.
Was it at that show in Calgary?
Yes.
That was a crazy ass show.
That crazy ass show. Yeah. That was the show where I was like, hey, wait a minute. You said like it kind of sounds like this. And I don't.
You guys were awesome.
Oh, thank you.
That was the first time I saw you guys.
Yeah.
And I think I probably read about you guys before that and exclaimed.
But yeah.
We hadn't played together.
No. And that was so fun. And that was just awesome. That was like felt like, okay, this is more like what I want to be doing. Like it's more. Like, obviously loved your band and, like, was kind of like, okay, this is sort of more the direction I want to do. Because when I was playing solo, I was also, like, opening for a lot of punk and emo bands where it's just, like, I just didn't feel welcome as a woman opening the shows. Like, it was very... And even friends of mine who were in bands that were screamo bands or big, I would ask for help or advice and I just, like, would not get it ever. So I felt like that community was really closed off and it was just not really working. And then once we started playing we were like slowly playing different kinds of shows. And when we played it Fucked Up, it was like more like, okay, this is, I don't know if it was Sled Island, but
I don't think it was Sled Island.
I think it was something else.
Well, maybe it was.
I don't know.
But no, I don't think it was, but it was like the same Sled Island people.
But like a different time
different
of year.
Different time of year.
Yeah.
Because I think we'd heard about Sled, they were telling us about Sled Island.
Okay, yeah.
Show.
Yeah.
But there was like a festival vibe to that thing that
right?
day.
Right? Because I feel like there was different rooms happening.
Yeah. Like, no, we both played upstairs that day.
Was there another?
There's some maybe, was it Sled Island Broken Social Scene was playing downstairs? Or was that another time?
Oh, wait.
Does that sound familiar?
It sounds like there was another... I remember there being another thing happening.
Yeah, in the basement. Yeah. Or like a big room downstairs. Yeah. And we played in that upstairs room.
Yeah, but I don't remember what it was. But I definitely remember feeling like, this is a little bit better.
Yeah.
This is more kind of the thing I want to do.
It's funny because, like, you know, obviously the show's called Turn It to Punk. And there's like so much like, punk is perfect.
Yeah.
But it's like... I could only imagine, well, I can't imagine what it's like to be in those scenes and dealing with how shitty men in punk can be.
Yeah, there's just like, I don't know. Like, it's not that I ever, my friends and I, who we go like do these interviews with bands and stuff, we've looked back now that we're adults, been like, that was a little weird that we like just spent a whole night in like a bus with people when we were 16 and these were all like 30-year-old dudes. Like, it's a little weird. A little weird that, like, you get the pee-pee pass, the pussy pass after you do your interview because the band wants you to come backstage after. We, like, experienced all that, but we were too, like, I just wanted to be in a band. I didn't care about the guys in the band. I just wanted to be in a band. So we just were like, okay, fuck you, I'm going to eat your writer. Like, I really don't care. I'm out of here. We got to get a train back to the suburbs. Like, I don't care. So we never experienced anything too harsh, but it was... Nobody was really helping. We were never taken seriously. I was never taken seriously doing it. It for a while, I was definitely like, maybe I suck. Maybe I'm just bad at it. But then when it I don't know. It just felt like there was nobody really helping. So I've definitely, since being in No Joy, tried to help like younger women trying to get work in music, whether it's like our sound engineer Madeline or a guitar player or somebody who wants to do art, like just trying to make that opportunity there because it definitely wasn't there when I started. So, you know,
and it's like, it's funny cause like that's the whole point behind the scene, right? Is
right.
to like big people up and try and help that next generation.
Yeah.
But dudes will be shitty dudes.
Yeah, for sure.
Like when you were playing those early shows, like, was it just sort of like, what kept you going then if you're dealing with so much shit? Like, what is it just this, like, no, I'm going to do this?
I don't know. Like, stupidity, I guess. Like, I remember I and by this point, like, I probably was a little bit older. I don't remember what age. I think maybe I was in college already. But, like, friends were going to Florida for spring break where they're like, woo, great spring break. And I was like, okay, I'm going to take the trip that's, like, organized by the school. But then I'm going to book my own tour in Florida.
Really?
Yeah, and I'm gonna bring my guitar and everything with me so you guys can go do your like spring break shit, but I'm gonna like book a Greyhound. So a lot of the tours I did were just like on Greyhound by myself. And I remember that tour that I did in Florida, in like Daytona. I don't know where Daytona is in Florida, if it's like mid, but I remember thinking like, I'm not in the safest neighborhood. It's like walking around playing these like random house shows just by myself. Like, why am I doing this? But I did it like a lot of times in different places. And sometimes like friends would come with me and then just be like, this is not fun. Wow. But a lot of it was just Greyhound and just saying like, okay, I just want to see stuff.
How did you like book those tours? Like, how did you know the people that you were kind of like reaching out to?
I didn't always know them. Yeah. And sometimes it was just like through Book Your Own Fucking Life.
Yeah, I was going to say, Book Your Own Fucking Life.
Yeah, sometimes through that. And then sometimes just through like other bands asking, but I think it was just the internet, really. They weren't great shows. They definitely weren't great shows, but I also just wanted to travel, kind of, and it was an excuse to go.
I think the punkest thing I've ever heard is hijacking your spring break trip so you can go on a tour.
And to make it worse, like, I didn't know what I was doing and, like, had my guitar back in our hotel room at one point, and everyone obviously went, like, swimming and to the beach and, like, dumped towels on my guitar, which then got like warped. But I still played the shows. It was fine.
Yeah. You probably were playing Sublime songs on it too.
Oh my god. Oh yes. Exactly. That definitely people were like, come on, sing. It's like, no. Not doing it.
That's the thing about, you know, like when we saw you guys in Calgary, like you were out there doing it, and from the sounds of it, you were like doing it on your own. Like, where did that inspiration come, or that drive come from, like, start just picking up? Is the lack of support you're getting from people back home?
Yeah, I think it was kind of like, I never really fit into any local scene.
Yeah.
And never really, like, I don't know. So I always wanted to tour, and I always wanted to, I had a big fear of flying too, so I never really saw anywhere. So I wanted to, like, see stuff. And Evan, who was here before, we kind of were always just like, hey, well, the best way to learn to do stuff is just to tour. Like, might as well just do it. And so it was a lot of tours where, which is funny now to think about it, it's just like, everybody put in this much money, we're going to go on tour. Like, we're all putting money towards a tour. Like, what the fucking hell was that?
We're going to lose.
We're going to lose.
More than this.
But this is, we're going to invest.
This is the base loss. Yeah.
And then, like, stupid moves like buying a van, where it's like, don't buy a van, like, you don't know what you're doing. But and
people don't tell bands
for sure not. And definitely, like, that was it. Like, we just thought to go play and just watch what other people were doing and where other people were playing. And to me, it always seemed like in Montreal, bands got bigger elsewhere first. Mm-hmm. And then once they got big, like, in the States or in Toronto, then Montreal would be like, oh, yeah, we always loved you.
Yeah.
So we just thought, like, fuck it, we're just gonna go somewhere else and play. So
kind of happens here that way too, though.
Yeah,
you have to go somewhere else and make it.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, we always supported you.
It's fun. We always loved you.
Yeah.
We
were
always,
like, no, always fans. It's not true.
Well, what was the transition then from Bad Floor to No Joy? Right, like, you guys moved to LA. Right?
Yeah, we kind of like.
Well, actually, sorry. How did you meet Laura?
I guess. Oh yeah, Laura was she moved to Montreal from Victoria, and she was 14 or 15, and she was like, there was like a message board called 20 Hertz or Style Post.
Yeah, Sally Post or whatever,
And so she was like the hot kid at shows. Like, who is this hot new kid from Victoria? There was always like a new scene kid, and she was the new scene kid. And then I just like asked her, like, do you want to play bass? And she was like, yeah, I don't know how. I was like, whatever. She worked at Underworld. I was just like, whatever. It's fine. We'll figure it out. It's fine. She had known Evan because they grew up kind of in the same neighborhood.
Okay.
So it was just like, she was just like a scene little kid that we met. And when we would do those bachelor tours, like, I would have to, I was over 18. I'd have to write a letter, get her parents to sign it that I was her, like, figure, like a
legal guardian
once we crossed the border. Like, because she was underage, and like, who are you taking, like, to America? You're smuggling this child. So we had letters like that, because, you know. But she, yeah, we did. That's where it started.
How many tours did Bad Flirt do?
We did a lot of them. We did a lot of them, and it was like, I can't even remember how many. Maybe like one cross Canada, and then maybe one full loop of the U.S. But we did a East Coast tours like over and over and over again. Yeah. We did like a few tours that like you know, in retrospect, don't share a van with a band you don't know. And don't trust them when they give you the amount of money you owe at the end, because they're probably ripping you off, which is something we figured out. We were getting ripped off by like a band that was like, yeah, do this tour with us, you can share our van, you just have to pay us this much money. And then the last day of the tour, I remember being like, wait a second, hold on, this math doesn't make any fucking sense, I'm not paying you this much. So it was a really learning experience.
Who was us. The band?
They were called Oppenheimer. They're from Ireland. They could
they came over here?
They came here. They asked us to share a van with them to tour. It was a maybe like North Carolina, Midwest, kind of went to Chicago, maybe 3 weeks or something. And we didn't have our own van. So they said, you could do the tour, you could share our van, you pay this much. And they had a driver TM that they wanted us to pay for, who wasn't doing anything for us either. It was just a really crazy experience.
How'd you meet them?
They emailed us, I think. They emailed us. This was like 2005.
Okay.
So they had emailed us and asked us to do the tour, and they just were like, by the last day, I remember Evan and I being like, wait a second, like, they're asking us to pay this much, but like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, yeah. The way it was broken down was just, we were just paying for the whole thing, whereas we weren't getting like guaranteed. They were getting guarantees. We were not getting anything. We were just getting a chance to play.
Yeah, you're covering the cost of the tour.
Yeah, we were covering the cost of the tour. I was like, okay, hold on. So we like split ways before the tour was over and like had to find our own way back home, and somebody's dad had to come get us and drive us back to Montreal. It was just like a mess. Yeah, it was a total mess. So word to the wise, don't split a van with people you don't know, or even people you do know sometimes.
Yeah,
it might not be the best experience.
Yeah, it depends on the band.
Depends on the band. Yeah, no. Depends on the band. Yeah. Depends on the band.
Make sure they're a nice, clean band. That,
yeah.
You know,
not just anybody who emails you.
Don't accept those cold
calls. Don't accept that.
How are you guys getting into the U.S.? Were you doing like recording contracts?
We were doing something so sneaky that if I say it publicly, I'm afraid.
Don't worry. Don't stay away from saying it then.
But we had figured out a way to do it.
Wow. Yeah, because we got dinged bad.
Yeah.
One time trying to cross.
Really?
Yeah. So it was like
we made lots of precautions to make sure.
It's become like it's so weird because, like, you know, once you're in a band and it's just like, you know, it sucks crossing the border, but you just do it. But, like, as a young kid, the risks you take.
I know. Five-year band. Like,
5-year bands.
For your, like, shitty show. That's nothing is worth that.
No.
I know. It's so crazy. And like, since No Joy, we've always had, we've always gone, like, legally on the visa thing. Yeah. But it's like, that would have been just so much easier than the stress before of like, going in with like this like kind of backwards way that we were doing it that worked every time, but like that was a gamble. We could have been banned for sure, which would have affected any kind of visa we got now.
Oh, it affects everything, right? Like, it's just you'd be dealing with it forever. And it's like, as a kid, you're like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Oh my god, no. It's so stupid. So stupid.
So sorry, I cut you off before the transition from Bad Flirt to Nova.
We did a bunch of touring that wasn't really going anywhere, and everybody had a lot of different expectations, and we had put out a full-length record that was like, nobody really knew what to do, kind of. I knew that I still wanted to make music, but it was like not really working, and we had some interest from people in LA, so we were kind of like, let's just go be in LA and like go see studios and not stuff that like doesn't really make any sense. But so we went to LA, and it turned into kind of a disaster where the drummer brought his now wife, but it was his girlfriend at the time, and they just made it into like a couple's trip. So I'd have meetings at studios, and they would say they couldn't go because they were going to Universal Studios, and I'd be like by myself and like, oh, okay. and Evan like decided it wasn't for him and left. So at one point I ended up being like the only member in Laura. Her mom got sick, so she like went back to Canada, so it ended up being that like I was the only person there.
Okay.
And I just started like going to shows by myself. So I went to The Smell, and I saw Best Coast, and I saw Miko Miko, and I just started seeing like bands where I'm like, oh shit, this is kind of like my level here. And Laura was in Montreal, but I just started emailing her being like, I'm really bored, I have all my gear here, let's just write some songs. And we just started writing songs, and we had like two or three, and Evan was booking a show through Blue Skies Turn Black, and he was booking Grant Hart. And he was like, oh, you're working on music? Do you want to open for Grant Hart? And I was like, yeah, we have two songs, but, like, okay, fine. And it was, like, 6 weeks later. So I went back to Montreal, and, like, Laura and I, like, tried to find people to play. It was so stupid. Like, it's going to be perfect. Two drummers, two singers. Like, we had this whole idea. But we, like, opened that show and had, like, two songs. But it was, like, it all kind of happened all in 1 week where, like, we played the show with No Joy, and I was like, I'm going to do this. And then I got my driver's license, and I, like, got a job, but then quit, and was like, I don't want this job. Fuck you. So it, like, all kind of happened all in the same week, and that was it. And then we put those two songs up on MySpace, and then Mix and Summer wrote us, like, not that long after.
That smell scene is just such a cool...
It's so cool.
It's awesome how, like, much different sounds...
Yeah.
...came out of it.
So many, and, like, yeah, so many different bands, and it was just such a cool thing to see in L.A. where I was seeing shows in, like, non-traditional spaces, and yeah. It was just, like, also because it was nice all the time, that you could just have a show outside, or mm-hmm. you can have a show in a backyard, you can have a show in, like... this little boutique, you could have a show at somewhere like The Smell, and there's just so many things happening all the time and so many people there, and I just was, I don't know, it was just like a moment where I was able to like pick up on a lot of new music, and mm-hmm. and that's where we just started writing this stuff.
Like, I think if I was gonna like, and I'm sure there were problems, but if I was gonna like be like, that was like an idealized punk scene,
mm-hmm.
I think it would be that,
yeah.
that time period, that
yeah.
scene, those
yeah.
bands that came out of it.
There was just something like, obviously, they've all like gone different ways, and some have blown up, and
yeah.
the industry kind of like poached a lot of it, but it was something so pure and so cool, and because a lot of it was all ages, was really mm-hmm. interesting, that there was no, it wasn't just about like, partying. It was kind of just about the show.
Yeah.
It was about like going to a show, which really reminded me of Lex or yeah. like places when I was a kid. Like you're gonna go to every show just to go to every show, even though you don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's yeah, that was kind of where.
I guess that's a scene.
Yeah, I guess that's a scene.
Right? Like where you're going, like I'm just gonna go.
I'm just gonna go hang out there.
Yeah, I'm just gonna see what's
yeah.
up. And like yeah, like I was there last year, 2 years ago, I guess,
yeah.
at The Smell.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like a whole new crop of bands,
yeah.
whole new crop of kids, but
yeah.
it's still like, it's still a scene.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's amazing how, you know, like, you remove yourself from it,
yeah.
and you're like, oh yeah, but it does carry on.
It does carry on, which is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're putting out Best Coast, Miko Miko,
yeah.
and Pagoda, and No Joy right now.
I know.
That's a pretty...
Who knows? They might.
It might be.
They
that's
might
a pretty
be.
Pretty intense run
yeah.
of bands right there.
It's funny, too, because we ended up being kind of lumped into, like... Next in Summer, when I kind of recounted the story, they just assumed I lived in L.A., and I was, like, from L.A.
Well, because I remember that bio
yeah,
coming out
bio.
About you.
The bio haunts me to this day, where people are like, you're from L.A. It's like, I was fucking in L.A. for, like, 3 months, unhappy in a room, like...
You guys didn't do that?
No.
We always thought...
No.
I remember talking to Tristan at the time, being like, why are they saying from L.A.? That's such a weird gimmick.
I know. And then, but then we just, like, got lumped into, like, all those L.A. lo-fi
yeah.
bands that were coming out. And then we ended up being part of, like, the scene that, like, I didn't know those people personally.
Yeah.
Like, I had no idea who they were. We never lived there. So, like, we tried to make corrections, but then, like... As soon as, like, one Pitchfork puts it or somebody else puts
yeah.
it, then it's like, okay, it's forever gone.
It haunts you.
It haunts, like, no one is from L.A.
It's
no
like
one
that,
is from there.
It's like that Tooth and Nail Screamo review.
Oh, my God. I'm haunted by the internet. There should be more, like, white glasses out there because there's not enough because that just comes up.
Yeah, that is definitely, that's so weird. I wanted to ask you, like, why did you guys say you were from L.A. at that time?
Yeah, no.
Oh,
no one ever
funny.
Did. And we had band members be like, why are you guys saying, like, we're not, why are you saying it's an L.A. band? It was like, honestly, it was like a miscommunication with the label writing the bio. Just we just said, like, yeah, we were in L.A. when
yeah.
we wrote these songs, but
yeah.
no one is from L.A. So it got, like, all that, like, beach pop, like, shoegazy stuff of, like, the late 2010. Like, we just got lumped into all those L.A. bands, but I didn't know any of them.
Yeah.
We didn't know any of them personally.
Now you do.
Now I do.
Yeah,
now I do.
Now
but
do.
But then I didn't know them at all.
Now it's proven true.
Yeah, now it's true. It came to be true.
It
but
came to be true.
Then it was not true at
Manifest
all.
Manifest destiny.
Yeah. Wait a second.
That was about so validating, though, because, like, you know, you guys were incredible. But I thought Bad Flirt was incredible,
Thank
too.
Thank you.
But to be, you know, get that recognition finally and to get that sort of, like, international awareness.
It was kind of weird. I think also Laura and I were really burnt out by Bad Flirt and by the, like, recording process we went through and, like, just the desperation of, like, I feel like when we were putting out Bad Flirt stuff, the music industry was in a weird time where, like, they didn't understand music blogs and, like, it's how to CD sales. Like, it seemed like a weird time. So our experience putting out Bad Flirt records on labels was quite bad.
What labels were you guys on?
There was a label called Cartel, and it was like an imprint of Universal in Quebec. So it was like kind of, it was like a rap label.
Okay.
And they had all these budgets for videos and this and that and play this private party and do this thing. And it just ended up being like kind of schmoozy.
Yeah.
So when we started No Joy, it was like no photos, no press, no anything. Fuck you. No. And I was telling the band the other day, it's just like, I think back to like, some really cool opportunities where I was just like, fuck you, no. And I was like, now I don't get them. But like in 2010, people were like, do you want to do this thing for this much money? I was like, I don't want to do anything. I don't want to do. When? But like that's, you're really hypey for like a second. And then, you know. Yeah. So at that point, I was kind of like, we didn't want to take any photos. We didn't want to put our names anywhere. We didn't want to have any videos with us in it. We didn't want to do anything. And then slowly realized like, if you don't do that, the press and the internet will just find something else.
Yeah.
They'll just make up their own. So their press photos ended up being used that were not ours, and it was just like, well,
you're from LA.
I'm from LA. Like, if you don't spell it out, we wanted it to be kind of anonymous, but people just made up their own stuff.
Well, it's funny too, because like, that's almost like the curse of punk, right? Like, when people start offering you these really cool things, but you're like, nah, that's shitty. Ian MacKay wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
I'm not in.
I know.
And then you're like,
now I'm in my 30s, like, I could use that money.
I wish I had done that. Fuck. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's like, how much is my Ian MacKay peace of mind worth now?
I know. It was just so, like, even little things about, like, sound, like, just like, we're gonna be so loud, fuck you, I don't care. You don't like it, I don't care.
I'm
like, oh, that's not really nice.
Yeah.
that's not really a nice thing to do, but yeah, we learned pretty quickly that if you don't tell people explicitly, they're just gonna assume. That's why people assume Laura sang till like now, probably. It's like, yeah, she never sang a note, but it's okay. If you don't tell them who sings, they're just gonna guess.
And it's like, people fill in their own narratives.
Yeah,
too,
totally.
And make up their own.
Oh my God. Yeah. We're sisters. Surprise.
How did you, I think that's the thing about Quebec that a lot of people don't, from outside of Quebec, realize is that it is a very distinct culture, especially musically.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's stuff that the label you brought up, I don't think any of that came outside of Quebec.
Yeah, it was, we had been trying to find like a record label, but it was just, again, it was like so, like when we started No Joy, it was like, I don't need a label, I'm just putting out this tape. We just like made a tape. Like, it was like, I don't want any of that industry stuff. Like, we tried with Bad Flirt, that was kind of dumb. Trying to like meet managers, inviting managers to shows, like, well, you don't need a manager, you don't need that shit. Like, we're just gonna do it ourselves. And then like found people in the end, but it was, the approach was like to go fully ourselves.
It's almost like that's what happens, I think, bands, when they do that, that's when they find the success, because
You're not caring that
you're
much.
Not trying. Like, everyone wants,
and nobody wants something that tries too hard. And we were probably, by the end of Bad Flirt, we were probably trying a little too hard just because we had invested so much of ourselves in it. But then with, you know, and also I'll credit Evan. One thing he told me when I started No Joy was like, he was like, you're not friends with any local bands. Like, you just have to have friends in bands. Like, just, if you're not, you don't feel part of a scene, just like make friends with bands. And I really took that to heart and like just made it a point to like get in touch with like Suna from the Ravenettes, who mixed our first record, just to be like, hey, I like your band. Like, let's be friends. And just trying to like, if you don't feel like you're part of a community, you can create your own community. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so with Bad Flirt, it was just like, find industry, or like find someone to help and then with No Joy, it was more just like, just surround yourself with like other bands you like and people you like and friends you like, and it doesn't matter about the rest of the stuff. And that kind of worked out, because some of the friends I made in like the beginning of No Joy are some of my dearest friends now.
Yeah.
You know, some of the first tours we did are just people I keep in touch with still. So, yeah.
Well, one local band that you probably may not have been friends with, but you certainly wound up with a member of, which is my familial relationship to your band, is Delicious Little Boys.
Oh, yeah. DLB.
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 How did... Because, like, it was so funny. Like, Garland... Like, I knew... It's so funny. He grew up, like, so quickly, you know, obviously, because he's a human being. But I remember him as a kid that was into, like... You know, all these like ska punk stuff and like.
Still is.
And pop punk. Oh, yeah, and he doesn't. He's not like he hides his stuff from exposing anything. But then he was in this kick ass, like shoegazy, awesome band. And I just missed that transition completely.
Garland was introduced to us by our bass player, Yan, who was in a Green Day cover band with him. And Garland came in one day and like, we. Played the songs, and like I forgot to tell him that on the two songs we had recorded, we had two drummers at the time, and we just had them both playing at the same time. And Garland was just like, "These drum parts are really crazy." I was like, "No, they're not." Like, but it was actually like two different drummers at the same time. So he was trying to do all these crazy things and play really fast, and it was just he is like a musical genius that he's not. He doesn't know. Like he doesn't. His ideas are so out of. They come from such a place that's, like, partially from a guy that listened to ska punk, but then also somebody that, like, says, I'm going to record some vocals on a little portable microphone, then put it in the dryer, then put the dryer on, then record the from the outside the dryer to get the vocal sound I want. You're like, what are you doing? He, like, has, like, on one of our records, he had, like, a butt dial from his mom that his mom was singing Jolene, like, to herself in the car. And then he's just like, we're going to play, he put that out, sampled that on a record. He got a,
I don't know if he's ever told Allison that she's on the record.
Oh, she's there. There's like a, he got this, waterproof bag where he would record something and then put it in the bag and then put it underwater, then put the tap on and then record the thing of the tap flow. It was just like, his ideas were so crazy that it was like, he wasn't coming from punk or ska or shoegaze. He was just like coming at it from like this, like. Other worlds, like I don't know. He had no like recording background or anything. He just wanted to like do cool stuff. And I think that's why. Like even his drumming style was like open hand and like all to the left, but he wasn't left-handed. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he'd wear a mask on stage. Sometimes he was wearing little shorts. Like it was always something. So he was truly like writing songs with him was always such a pleasure because he would just. I would present something, and then he would hear something that I was like, I don't know where you came up with that. He would have, like, a completely different view on it.
Well, you got to play soon, or you got to get back to the show soon. Yeah, Pete is one of the wildest dudes I've ever met. How did you meet Pete?
We played Primavera years ago, which another funny story about Garland was, like, I turned around during that show, and Garland wasn't at his drum set. And I was like, what the fuck is going on? And I saw he had taken the smoke machine that they had put behind him and was just, like, smashing it. He was just, like, fed up with the smoke in his face. And I was like, okay. But we played there, and I remember that Pete was at the show, and we had a manager at the time, and I was like, oh, can you introduce me? And our manager was like, I don't think so. I'm not going to introduce you. So I'm like, fine, I'm just going to email him myself. So I emailed, and we just kind of, like, kept in touch. And I always wanted to work with him on something, but it was just how.
Yeah.
And, like, where. He was sometimes in New York, sometimes in London, and then he had just moved to Portugal and kind of set up shop, like, isolated, like, by himself. And I had these songs that were never going to become No Joy songs. They were just sort of floating. And I just sort of asked, like, do you want to work on this? And I don't care what you do. Like, free reign, what do you think we should do? And that's kind of how it happened.
Did you work, did you guys do it over the internet?
Over the internet, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So have you ever hung out with them?
No.
I remember I think it was at that Primavera too.
Really, yeah.
I remember being backstage and he busts out this battery and opens it and then all this hash comes out. Oh. I'm like, this is the coolest dude I've ever met. Sonic Boom rules.
He would, like... He would tell me about his place in Portugal and all the different plants and the fruits that are there. And, I'd be like, oh, that's really lovely. Like, they sound really nice. And I would get high-res pictures of his breakfast. Like, oh, I took this plant off the tree and I made this. And I'd get, like, the high-res pictures of, like, his yogurt with this fruit that he picked off the tree. It was very cute, very sweet. But, yeah, I never partied with him or anything. Yeah. We just worked on the song.
Yeah, because you're not, like, a weed person.
No, not really. No.
You're missing out on a great opportunity to smoke weed with Sonic Boom.
I know.
So many people I know have been like, I used to buy weed off that dude.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like back in the day.
Oh, man. Yeah, he's, I mean, he has a really great, like, way of writing emails where yeah. he'll just say, like, if he's saying, let us talk about it tomorrow, he'll write, like, lettuce, like a head of lettuce.
Lettuce.
Like, let us talk about it tomorrow. Like, really cool style. And he just was such a dream to work with, honestly. He came up with, like, crazy ideas.
And like, a music genius, too. Yeah. Like someone
totally.
Who definitely thinks out of the box.
Totally. And totally doesn't always get credit for it, too.
Yeah.
He does a lot of stuff people don't realize that he did.
Yeah.
So.
It's funny. He hasn't been, you know, spiritualized is on a certain place. But, he hasn't been rediscovered in the same way.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem.
And it's weird because he worked on the Beach House record and things like that where they're, like, huge audiences, but he's not parading being like, it's me, I did this thing. And worked with MGMT and Panda Bear and stuff like that where he's so integral to those records, but he's not a showy guy, I don't think.
He's legit cool.
He's legit cool. Like, he doesn't care if you like it or he doesn't care if you know it's him. He just did it because he wanted music.
To do it.
Yeah. So that makes the myth even crazier.
It's kind of, like, I imagine you're like me and this is just like, it's so awesome that, you know, Manifest Destiny, like, where you're, like, now working with the guy from Spaceman
3. I know, it's insane. I know. That, it's so crazy to me, still, that, like, he took these songs and, like, worked on them with me. It's so crazy.
Well, I think it's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think, honestly, your journey is inspiring. Thank you. And
Glue Leg.
Yeah, Glue Leg. From Glue Leg to Bad Flirt to No Joy.
Here we are.
Here we are.
It's a crazy journey. Where to next?
We're going to go dig up the bones of the guys from Glue Legs and that cupboard over there.
Oh, my God. Maybe he works here. Like, I don't even know.
I don't think so. I hope not. No, Teddy Fury works here, who played in the Bobcats.
Oh.
One of the best rockabilly bands ever in Canada. So,
so no Glue Leg. But maybe there's a Glue Leg
signature. There's probably some Glue Leg signatures here. My God. Anyway, Jasmine, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. I'm so glad we did this finally.
You can come back for a part two one day, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Thank you, Jasmine, for coming on the show. And you heard right there at the very, very end, I got it in there. We're going to be back for a part two at some point in the future. Also, if you're like, who's the sibling? And you didn't bother searching the last names on your phone. Alisa from Arch Enemy is Jasmine's sister. Very different vocals. Like, I was racking my brain earlier trying to think if there are sibling vocalists that have that diverse kind of vocal sounds. Like, Damnation AD and Battery don't sound vocally that different. You know, I like, there are differences in those vocals. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, I think as far as siblings go, this has got to be it, right? Like, this is the most incredibly diverse range of pipes in a family. Yeah, I think we're safe saying that. Anyway, Jasmine will be back, and I will bring up my theory to her next time she's on the show. Speaking of next on the show, I got something really cool. Next week on the show, I got Jesse Michaels from Operation Ivy and Common Rider and, you know, a bunch of other amazing projects as well. But, yeah, get ready. This is a fun one. This is someone that, fuck, I've always wanted to talk to. I'd never gotten a chance to meet this person. And this is a cool episode that went to a bunch of different music places that I didn't think it would go that are all super awesome for me to get to talk about. This was one of those ones where I'm like, damn, I'm glad I do this podcast, you know, because once in a while, you get to talk to someone you never got to talk to. And it's someone that you've always wanted to talk to and always been fascinated by their journey. And yeah, that is next week on the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, you can go out there and make your own culture because anyone can do this stuff. Like, I've gotten to do a lot of dumb shit just by being persistent with it and trying stuff out and just hoping that there were people out there that got it. And luckily, there are people out there that get this stuff. So go out there and make your own culture. Do your own shit. And I will see you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Bye.